Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of May 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we're delighted to say we're joined by live video Skype link by Mark Anderson from American Free Press and also the Truth Hound blog.
.com, yeah.
Where do we start? I think we better start with May Day, which of course produced scenes of violence across the world. So if you just have a little look on YouTube here, there's footage from Germany, from France, from Italy, from the States. And some of this was just outrageous, particularly in France, petrol bombs being used. This policeman seriously burned. And what I'd just like to bring home to our audience, of course, is this is exactly the action which so many governments around the world love, because the moment the demonstrators using violence on the streets, the governments can get extra funding for ever more brutal police. And then they can produce the clampdown, they can move towards the curfews. So this type of violence is wrong. And of course, it only takes a few of George Soros's paid agitators to help create this sort of situation on the streets. So our message is very clear. If you want to stop the violence that governments are employing, then we have to be very, very measured and calculated in what we do. But of course, that doesn't mean take no action. It means take the right action. And I'll just give a mention also to Sergeant Al Blackman. Of course, he was released just before the weekend. But I was intrigued by this article in The Guardian where he's quoted as saying, "Being out of prison is an immense feeling, but I am very conscious that my sentence is not complete. I have been released on licence and there are certain conditions which I must and will respect." Well, the UK column has consistently said this man was a conservative political prisoner. His imprisonment was designed to attack the morale of British armed forces. And we're going to guess that his conditions include gagging and a limitation on what he can say about prosecution of unlawful wars by the British government. So very, very dirty dealings. And of course, when was Al Blackman released? Just at the right time for the Conservatives to cruise off. Aren't we nice people? We've actually let him out after 3.5 years. It's pretty cynical stuff, Mike.
Yes. Well, let's move across the pond then and bring Mark in a second. And first of all, we'll start off with Trump's latest reaction to North Korea. Now, I have to say that the ability to turn 180 degrees on a dime seems to be the feature of the modern political leader, Brian. And whether it's Jeremy Corbyn on the Bradbury Pound or Theresa May on whether to hold a general election or not, or Donald Trump on just about anything. But yesterday he told Bloomberg News that it would be appropriate for me to meet Kim Jong-un, and I would be honoured to do it. He said, if it's under, again, the right circumstances, but I would do that. He said, most people would never say that, but I'm telling you that under the right circumstances, I would meet him. We have breaking news. So, Mark, where is Donald Trump's foreign policy at the moment? Does he actually know what he's doing? Is he just getting so many competing voices around him that he's not quite sure which way to move?
Certainly that is one distinct possibility. Hope I'm coming through okay here today. The big question with Donald Trump is this the way he is, or is this the way his advisors are urging or prodding him to be? He's got this neoconservative circle. He promised to drain the swamp, but he's surrounded by people that have a lot of very deep financial interests, many of whom are multimillionaires or billionaires themselves. And so the neoconservatives in the West Wing of the White House are certainly a big factor. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and H.R. McMaster has a very neoconservative pro-war attitude, as does Mattis, the defense secretary. So the big thing with Trump is just who's in charge, Donald Trump or the pro-war neoconservative wing? That is one very important question that's not fully answered yet.
Okay, well, let's move on to Yemen, because this is Todd Young, United States Senator for Indiana, and he has managed to organize a group of nine senators from both sides of the House, both sides of the Senate, rather, and they've sent a letter to the Saudi ambassador in Washington demanding that Saudi Arabia ceases bombing in Yemen. So this has been led by Senator Todd Young, includes Senators Chris Murphy, John Boozman, Patrick Lee, Cory Booker, Jeff Markley, Richard Durbin, and a number of others. And they're saying that they want to alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni people. They want to lead full support to Defence Secretary Mattis' call for political settlement in Yemen, and they call upon the Saudis to refrain from bombing. This continues to be completely underreported, the situation in Yemen and the UK. Is Yemen still off the radar in the media in the States?
There's certainly not mention of it right now much. The big thing in the States is the debt ceiling, the perennial non-issue that is actually an issue in a sense, but it's never explained properly. We're possessed by that. Donald Trump didn't attend the White House Correspondents' Dinner. That's big in the news. He went and spoke at a rally in Pennsylvania. There's lots of this stuff about North Korea and innumerable issues. Russia's still out there, but no, this Yemeni thing is virtually non-existent at this time.
Okay, well now, about 2 weeks ago, I think I had Vanessa Bealey on the program, and we showed this map, amongst other things, and she was discussing the issue of safe zones and the ultimate drive towards the Balkanization of Syria, potentially. She saw this as a danger. Well, the Astana talks continue tomorrow. They are scheduled again for tomorrow. And Russia has released a four-point plan on how the ceasefire in Syria should proceed. And it seems to be very much along these kinds of lines. Now, on here we've got we're seeing a Russian safe zone, a couple of American safe zones, a Turkish safe zone. There's no US safe zones mentioned in the Russian plan. They're talking about Russia, Turkey and Iran running these safe zones. And if you want more detail on this, have a look at the Sputnik article. Russia proposes creation of four zones of reduction of tension in Syria. So this is what they're calling them. It says Russia proposes creating four zones of reductions of tension in Syria, in Idlib province, north of the city of Homs, in Eastern Ghouta, and south of Syria. And they're saying the war parties in these areas would not be able to use weapons. They're saying that it's necessary to create conditions to drive out ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra terrorists. They say that they're creating safety lines along all the borders of the de-escalation zones in order to avoid direct fire between the sides of the Syrian conflict. And they're saying that Russian proposals on de-escalation in Syria envisage possible deployment of guarantor states armed groups in the country for ceasefire monitoring and the creation of joint working group to elaborate a plan with de-escalation borders shortly. So, as I say, they're talking about Russian safe zones, Turkish and Iranian. So you heard it here first, because Vanessa was talking about this a couple of weeks ago, extremely concerned about it. I think the feedback that she's getting from Syria is really the Syrian people don't quite understand what's going on here. But clearly, we're talking about Russia, Brian, and therefore they're playing a particularly clever game of chess, perhaps.
That's what I think's going on, because on one hand, we've got a number of people who say, oh, well, the Russians have done what they've done, but you watch, they're going to play the same hand as the US. They're in the same global game. I think there's something very subtle going on here. Of course, it's the US and the UK that are pressing for regime change. Assad's got to go, and then we're going to break up and partition the country. So what have the Russians done? They've got in first. They've made the suggestion. They're not saying Assad's got to go. They're saying Assad stays, but we need to actually get the country more secure by bringing in these safe zones. So more or less, it's now thrown the whole debate back in the UK-US camp, and I think it's going to make it very difficult.
Absolutely.
For them, sorry.
Yes.
For the US and UK.
Absolutely. Well, in parallel, of course, we've got this whole rhetoric over chemical weapons use in Syria over the last number of weeks, suggestions from the UK that should there be any further chemical incidents in Syria, that the US and the UK would have to get involved in some way. Here we have Human Rights Watch. George Soros-backed organization, of course, saying that Syrian government forces have used what they're describing as deadly nerve gas in four recent attacks, they say. It describes a clear pattern of chemical weapons use that could amount to crimes against humanity. Of course, there's no evidence presented.
Well, it's a minor problem for the US and UK. You don't need evidence if...
Absolutely not. No evidence required. According to Kenneth Roth, the executive director of Human Rights Watch, he said the government's use of nerve agents is a deadly escalation and part of a clear pattern. In the last 6 months, the government has used warplanes, helicopters and ground forces to deliver chlorine and sarin in Damascus, Hama, Idlib and Aleppo. That's widespread and systematic use of chemical weapons. Let's see the evidence, please. And I'll just mention this article that's gone up on the UK Column website yesterday, because this next 4 weeks is the critical time. We had Boris Johnson saying a week or so ago that, of course, the issue of whether or not Parliament would have to give approval to military intervention for UK military intervention in Syria, that issue would have to be tested. Well, of course, we now have the situation that as of tomorrow, Parliament is dissolved. Therefore, there is no Parliament to make a decision either way. And I'm suggesting here that that is puts us into a high risk period for intervention. And I end up here quoting Vanessa from yesterday, making the point that the White Helmets have moved into a particular area of Syria, and she's expecting to see a new chemical weapons video appearing in the not too distant future. That's all it would take. And so I think that's why we're in this high risk.
And then we would have a decision made by not a Westminster decision, but this would be effectively an emergency meeting by Boris and Fallon and Theresa May.
Well, exactly, because while MPs lose their seats, while there's a general election, they vacate their seats, they're unemployed as MPs, including Theresa May. She is unemployed as an MP, but she is never unemployed as a Prime Minister until there's a new government formed. And so the executive continues to operate, and she would simply use the royal prerogative to cause the intervention.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the public's kept in the dark.
Absolutely.
Yeah, totally. Do we want to bring Mark in here for a bit of comment?
Any thoughts, Mark?
Certainly, it's a very perilous time. You guys are very astute in bringing this out. That's the main thing I would say. The executive always leans towards war. That's, of course, an historical lesson that we all ought to know if we don't know it already. And this harkens back to 2013 when I met Congressman Justin Amash in Battle Creek, Michigan, and they signed a letter to then President Obama against a U.S. intervention in Syria. And at that time, the bombs were ready, the planes were ready, I understand, to go into Syria for the first alleged chemical attack. So this is recycling now 4 years later, from the summer of 2013 till now. They just won't give up. They don't want to take no for an answer. The U.S. and the U.K. could not go into Syria then, but they're chafing at the bit to go in now. And all indications are that they'll very well likely try this trick, this maneuver that you guys are talking about. So they don't want to give up. They don't want to hear the word no, like the Congress tried to in the U.S. back then. They tried to say no. So they don't want to hear it. The neoconservatives are you know, relentless. So you guys are pointing out something very scary, but very important to get out there. So we'll see if they can hold off war once again.
Adrian in the chat box making the point that Assad had invited the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons to Syria to investigate the most recent alleged attack. This is something that the Russians have called for as well. I think the OPCW is now an utterly discredited organization because they're basing their allegations of recent chemical attack in Idlib on what? On testimony from the White Helmets, which is in itself is a discredited organization now. They didn't go there. They didn't get any on-the-ground data. They didn't do any kind of forensic investigation on the ground. All that happened was that bodies were sent to Turkey, and apparently, if you believe the British government, some bodies were sent, or some material anyway, was sent to Port and Down, and they were able to identify sarin, or as they described it, a sarin-like substance, as part of those autopsies, and that whatever material was sent to Port and Down. Nobody knows what the circumstances were. How did those people get killed? Were they killed? Seems to have happened in the Rushdie.
Yeah, it's the provenance, isn't it? It's the provenance of the evidence and the due diligence in how that evidence is then handled on its journey back to a lab to be forensically investigated. And of course, there's no provenance and there's no due diligence. So any results are automatically highly suspect.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to other defence matters now. A couple of weeks ago, we had this image of the F-35 up, and the headline was stealthy price tag. Well, it appears it's not such a stealthy price tag anymore, because this is the GAO, the Audit Office in the United States, basically pushing out a report yesterday saying F-35 Joint Strike Fighter DOD needs to complete development testing before making significant new investments. What are they saying here? They're saying that cascading F-35 testing delays could cost the Department of Defense over $1 billion more than currently budgeted to complete development of the F-35 baseline program because of problems with the mission system software. It was the mission system software that was being crowed about in recent war games, I do believe.
Well, they were crowing about it, Mike, as if it had been fixed, but clearly it hasn't been fixed. We don't know whether the engine problems, the tendency to burst into flames, has been fixed. We don't know if the corrosion problems have been fixed. And at the end of the day, all of the reports say that this aircraft is not performing as it was supposed to. For us, Mark, of course, the important thing is that this the Royal Navy is totally dependent on this aircraft as the onboard aircraft for the new Queen Elizabeth class aircraft carriers. So if this aircraft doesn't perform, we don't have a performing Navy anymore. There are some other implications. But this has been a pretty disastrous program.
Well, what they're saying is that if it takes the estimated 12-month delay, that's going to cost another $1.7 billion.
Well, of course, that's not a problem, because Trump's been just promised another $15 billion for defence. We might as well bring that up, and then we can perhaps ask Mark. This is the Daily Mail here. Trump's trillion-dollar deal. Congress agrees to spend $15 billion more on the military and $1.5 billion on border security, but no wall. We'll just stick with the defence side. We've got to remember that the Federal Reserve creating billions from nothing. So this all starts on fraud in the first place. And then, of course, as many media sources are pointing out, the whole of the American financial system depends on the American aircraft carriers, whatever it is, 10 of them and 12 due in total. And we know that the US aircraft carriers equal foreign policy. So anywhere the carriers go, American democracy goes. But this is the other point. With the American money, defense money flooding the defense procurement market, we are predicting that we're going to see the demise of British aerospace, BAE Systems, and Rolls-Royce, because at the moment the two British companies have too few orders, so the value is very low, and this American money is going to pose a direct risk. Mark, there's a lot happening here behind the scenes, but it seems Trump is to get what, a total of $50 billion, I think I read somewhere, for defence. This is just paper money.
Well, certainly, yeah. It's interest-bearing money. That, you know, the creation of money by banks is not necessarily itself the problem. It's that it's created in a usurious, interest-bearing, monstrous, ever-growing debt. If the government were to create it directly and not borrow it from the banks and match that with production levels, you could have a much more proper and equitable creation of money that would be a positive, not a negative, a progress and not a debt. And we could talk about that more another time. Money creation, of course, is the main power possessed by private banks that belongs to the people. And that's the main engine of tyranny. Without that, tyranny would largely abate. Tyranny would be much less prevalent. That being said, coming out of that money creation, of course, is the fact that the private sector, the establishment, works in tandem with the government to create this huge defense establishment, because they have to create enemies. Why do governments borrow? The biggest reason they borrow is war. and war creates the largest spending and therefore the largest usury, the interest and the debts. This is sort of the whole foundation of the establishment that we face. That being said, you mentioned the border wall. You know, the wall is sort of a challenging issue. If you look at the Rio Grande River, which I do on a frequent basis, I go down there in South to build a wall. What side of the river do you build it on is one question. I hope I'm coming through okay, but where to put the wall? Do we put it on the Mexican side of the Rio Grande River? Do we put it on the U.S. side? You can't very well put it right down the middle of the river, right in the water. So the wall has all sorts of logistical issues with it. The real issue is Mexico's southern border with Belize and Guatemala and El Salvador. Mexico's southern border is the real key issue. If the U.S. would work with Mexico to fix that southern border, much of the human trafficking and the exodus out of Central America could be trimmed way back, because most of the people crossing the border in Texas right now are not Mexicans. They're from Central America. So if we want real progress, Trump needs to say to Nieto, the Mexican president, let's fix the Mexican southern border. So that whole issue is really misfocused. It's out of whack. And that's where the real issue lies in Central America at the Mexican border.
Mark, a number of issues there, but the key one for me is the fact that we've got this money created from nothing by the central banks. Therefore, they are the people pulling the strings. This is a Russia Today one, but just bring it on screen here. We've got Tomahawk missile strike on Syria was after dinner entertainment for, and that was a quote by the U.S. Commerce Secretary. I've just put a label on it. Death is after dinner entertainment for the low empathy personality. This is very dangerous stuff. If Trump is crowing that he thought it was almost amusing to spend somewhere up to $100 million on that cruise missile strike, which ultimately killed 14 people. And even he admits that, yes, probably a few people who shouldn't have been killed were killed. We seem to be dealing with increasingly obvious low empathy, sociopathic, psychopathic people.
Oh, indeed. Certainly the establishment that we live under, it creates over time, over generations, it induces a mentality of complete disregard for human life as more and more wealth accrues to the top. And the large base of the population has to struggle day by day, week by week, month by month, just to live, just to pay the rent, as it were. No doubt about it. And then you have the generational thing, the Rothschilds and the long bloodlines where lots of wealth has been encapsulated for multiple generations. Over time, it creates this royalty mentality in the moneyed elite, in the plutocratic elite, where the rest of humanity is nothing more than cattle to them, people that are supposed to work for them and not better their own lives. And that's the ultimate arrogance that we're up against, is the money-induced plutocratic generational elite and the defense and monetary establishments and the usury that they create. That of course, is it's an extremely seductive thing, even to new people on the power ladder. And that's what seduces people into supporting the system, because it pays so many spoils, it pays so many perks to be part of the system. And then they close ranks on the rest of us in what you might call regular society. And it's sad to see Trump falling into that trap, because many people at the recent Harrisburg, Pennsylvania rally, they want to see something more from Donald. They want somebody who's on their side. They believe he's a populist. I think he does have that impulse in him. But whether Trump is this way himself or he's being seduced into all this, either way, it's disheartening to see him fall into this power trap that we thought that he was not part of, that many Americans believe he is not part of. The real test for Donald Trump is to prove who he really is. And that's going to be really critical over the next few months.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Mark. Let's come on to Bundy. Now, Patrick Henningsen covered this issue, the Bundy situation in Nevada. How many years ago was that?
When he first did that would have been 2014. So
this has taken quite some time to get to trial then?
Oh, yes. The whole idea of a fair and speedy trial, as understood in U.S. jurisprudence and the U.S. Constitution, the very idea of a fair and speedy trial, it's a little early here on the West Coast, that is being undermined just by itself, let alone all the other questions. A fair and speedy trial is really kind of off the table now. This is a very glacial thing. It's moving very slowly.
And so what's going on with it then?
Well, the very latest is that in the first of three trials, four of the six were found not guilty by the 12-member jury, and that was on April 24th, if memory serves. The other two were found guilty of some charges. And then there's two more trials in the three-part case here. And those other two trials are supposed to be June 26th, and that's the second trial. And then the third trial is supposed to be sometime in the fall. Now, they're going to retry the four that were found not guilty. The government is very insistent that the Bundy people, Clive and Bundy, his sons and their supporters, the government is very insistent that they're a far right-wing menace, a virtual militia that committed some sort of virtual insurrection when they protested Bureau of Land Management property rights at that famous standoff in April of 2014. So the government doesn't want to give up. So they're going to retry those first four that were found not guilty. And get this, the retrial date is also June 26th, which is the same date as the second trial when that one's supposed to begin. And that's the high profile one involving Clive and Bundy and a couple of his sons and the radio journalist Pete Santilli. And Cliven has a total of four sons involved in this. And so it's very glacial. The government doesn't want to give up. And one of the latest things is that Ryan Bundy, one of those four sons, has filed a lawsuit. And that was just a week ago, Monday, in U.S. District Court in Nevada. And he's saying, Ryan Bundy, that he's been forced and threatened to undergo oppressive, intrusive, and unlawful body cavity searches. And he's saying that these intrusive body cavity searches are pretty relentless. And he's also claiming that he's been put in solitary confinement much of the time. Now, if you're in prison the whole time, why you would need constant body cavity searches is beyond me. But it seems to be an intimidation, an attempt to break him down mentally and physically and psychologically. And that's the very latest is Ryan Bundy's suing over these strip searches. So a lot of things are coming up, but the government seems to be trying to shake these guys down to keep them in jail as long as possible and to break them physically and mentally and erode their defense, because so far, actually, they're winning. Bit by bit, the government is failing, and the government is very desperate to make things stick, and this is what they're resorting to, even strip searches.
Okay, so you're there to cover this. So how much longer are you expecting to be on the West Coast then?
I'm not sure. I'm a little bit on holiday and doing some news work right now. I'm covering this part-time. The more direct coverage will come up in latter June or early July. They're probably going to end up bumping the second trial into early July and challenge the idea of a fair and speedy trial even more because of their rather questionable, if not ridiculous, suggestion to have the retrial of the first four that were found not guilty by the 12-member jury. So the most difficult thing about this is for the alternative media to be able to cover this at all because they keep moving the trial dates. And I almost suspect that's on purpose. So only the bought and paid for conventional media, especially the local, the Las Vegas Review Journal, which is owned by Sheldon Adelson, I might add, the casino mogul who has supported with billions of dollars a lot of conservative politicians and tried to support Ted Cruz against Donald Trump, Adelson being one of the big money men in the U.S. political system. At any rate, he owns the Las Vegas Review Journal, but the media, the government seems to be trying to stack the deck so the alternative media is constantly having to reschedule and will have a much harder time covering this. That's not proven, but that's what I suspect.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I'll just add to that that those techniques being used in prisons seem to be operating in UK prisons as well, where people are clearly being harassed, victimized and assaulted when they should be being protected by the state in prison. The opposite is happening in order to achieve political objectives. And where are we seeing this in particular? Well, we're seeing it around the government, the British government's attempt to cover up child abuse. So we're just bringing this advert for this unique conference happening in Perth tomorrow. Andy Peacher and his team have put this together. This is basically child abuse survivors and supporters coming together to say, well, if the government is not going to investigate, we are going to do it ourselves. So the event is all day from 9:15 at the Station Hotel, Leonard Street in Perth. If you can get to that, please do. There's live speakers and also some video talks. I've put in one of those. I'm sure it's going to be an excellent and much needed event. So if you can support, please do.
Now, this morning on the Radio 4 Today programme, they were discussing Theresa May, Brian, and they were asking the question of, or they were highlighting the issue of Theresa May's public meetings. And, you know, she has expressed recently the desire to get out and meet the electorate. She's really happy to do that. She loves it. And so she's going to be doing lots of it. But in fact, what even the BBC was being forced to acknowledge was that, well, any of the meetings that she seems to be running are for Conservative Party members only. So the Conservative Party members were receiving email invitations to her so-called public meetings, and that other people were not getting a look in.
This is because they're very worried, Mike. They are worried because they know that the hostility amongst the wider public is growing, and quite rightly so. The other thing is that Theresa May has shown herself to be gaffe-prone. And who knows what may come out of her mouth. I think she's looking very wobbly. I think this lady could have a breakdown. She would need to be replaced. So I think they're treating her with kid gloves, and you wouldn't want a future prime minister interacting with the public. That would be terrible.
Absolutely. So it came as no surprise then to see this tweeted out earlier on from Steve Smith, who's with Cornwall Live, one of the local media outlets. And the Prime Minister is in Cornwall today, apparently, and he's tweeted out, "Never known a visit like this. Are reporters banned from watching Prime Minister walk around a factory by the Conservatives PR team?" So Theresa May was in Cornwall this morning walking around a factory, but journalists weren't allowed to report on what she was doing. That's quite an incredible situation.
Well, everywhere, Mike, we're seeing the PR teams control the agenda. We can see it with phoning up any local authority and trying to get some sort of answer from a real person. You only ever deal with the PR team. And in a minute, we'll demonstrate the sorts of nonsense you can get from those PR teams, including that from the Independent Police Complaints Commission. So, I'm not surprised. Just remember Theresa May's weakness, because, of course, she's up against the might of the European Union. This headline made me laugh. EU leaders agree on negotiating stance for Brexit talks in record 4 minutes. So we are to believe that there was a discussion which lasted 4 minutes and these EU people agreed. Well, of course, the reality is that the outcome of that meeting would have been pre-agreed in pre-meeting meetings, which is exactly the way you do things in a dictatorship.
I maintain that everything that's happening with Brexit was negotiated at the time of David Cameron's grand tour of Europe. So it was all agreed 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing now is pure charade.
Pure theatre.
Mark, bring you back in at this point, because this has been rumbling on for quite some time, and that's the issue of Glass-Steagall and the breakup of the big banks in the United States. And it was very much a willy-won't-he thing. And certainly the momentum seems to be building on the side of he will, to the point that while in the last couple of weeks the Financial Times has been mentioning this from time to time, the other mainstream media really wasn't covering it, but it has now broken into the UK media, with the Independent here saying Donald Trump actively considering breaking up Wall Street's biggest banks, and similar headlines on the BBC and other mainstream media here. So the question is, will he do it? It's looking more and more likely, much to the chagrin of the Wall Street elites. I'm kind of dropping this on you from a great height, because I didn't tell you we were covering this, but have you any thoughts on whether he will actually deal with this issue?
I don't know. excuse me. This is a difficult one to answer. I can say that when you've been part of the New York business establishment for as long as Donald Trump has in real estate, and Donald Trump for many years, his attorney was the influential Jewish attorney Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn cut his teeth as the legal counsel to Joe McCarthy, the Wisconsin senator back during the communist scare, the famous senator that had the probe of communists in the US government. That's where Roy Cohn came from. Well, fast forward, Roy Cohn was the attorney to Donald Trump for many years when Trump got into real estate through his father. And so, considering all that Trump has needed and wanted and done through the New York financial establishment to get where he is, it would be difficult to believe that Donald would bite the hand of the banks this hard. Of course, when you break up banks, what does that mean? When they broke up Standard Oil back in the early 1900s in the famous Standard Oil trust busting court trial, did they really break up Standard Oil? Well, they converted it into separate entities, Standard Oil of Ohio, Standard Oil of Indiana, but the power of Standard Oil was not abated when they broke it up. So when they talk about breaking up banks, what do they really mean? The banking consortium has power in and of itself. Whether the banks are multiplied a little more or broken down a little more, the power to create money, again, with interest-bearing debt and the way the banks work, that's their real power. So I would question what breaking up the banks even really means. Now, if you have Glass-Steagall and you have a firewall between investing and regular commercial banking, and that's what Glass-Steagall was partially about, that's a useful thing.
Well, look, I'm just gonna jump in there, Mark, because what you've just said is an interesting point. It actually goes beyond a firewall because what is required for Glass-Steagall is the full separation of the corporate institution. So fully separating investment banking operations from retail banking operations. What we have in this country since 2010 or so is what you describe as a firewall. Here we call it the ring fence. There is some discussion of watering down these proposals in the States and imposing a ring fence instead. The ring fence hasn't worked here. It's not going to work anywhere because it's not really achieving the main aims of separation, of proper separation. All it's doing is putting a PR spin on a minor restructuring. I mean, you're right. These are all key points. What Trump needs to do, and we're going to explain one reason why he needs to do it, because again, we're seeing bubble after bubble building. In this case, ETF Daily News highlighting the corporate debt levels. But as I've shown on many occasions, my donut graph of UK debt, government debt, corporate debt, household debt is at record levels in the West as well. We continue to carry an unmanageable debt burden. It can't be repaid. And so unless Trump goes for Glass-Steagall, Mark, I don't see any option out of the mess that they are in. And I'm talking about the financial elites here, other than to create a fairly massive war, which will solve the problem within a very few years.
Yeah, the monetary system we have survives on war. Without war, they wouldn't be able to create the necessary amounts of credit and borrowing, and the economic engine wouldn't turn quickly enough and with enough force to keep the economy going. That's the sheer poison of the current system, is it needs large-scale ventures like war, not necessarily limited to war, but like war just to survive. That's the great crime of the financial system that we would need to break out of via the Bradbury Pound, via similar systems, maybe along the social credit lines or some sort of distributism rather than redistributing the wealth. We need to distribute new debt-free money into the economy to make up for the huge shortfall of purchasing power. And many debts would need to be repudiated. Not all debts are legitimate. Fraud vitiates contracts, and wherever there's
And
fraud.
that is part of the Glass-Steagall process is to make an assessment of the validity of the debt.
That's a good thing. Yeah, if it's more than a firewall and a true separation, that would be a very welcome thing. The thing with Donald Trump is his financial interests run so deep in the New York establishment. Can he really bite the hand that's fed him and helped him along? Roy Cohn, that attorney I mentioned, is one of the more, he's the late Roy Cohn now. He died, but he was extremely influential in the earlier New York establishment and helped Donald Trump get where he is, helped him build these Trump towers all over the place, directly or indirectly. Will Glass-Steagall be fully reinvigorated in the U.S.? Many bankers are known to keep on their wall these plaques that say, I helped defeat Glass-Steagall. And Glass-Steagall came out of the U.S. Great Depression years, as you guys know. It was one of the last surviving measures against the trusts, against the money power. And so hopefully something with some teeth and some real meaning can be reinstalled in the U.S. and in the U.K. systems to create that checks and balance, because real checks and balances are so woefully lacking right now, especially financially. And so we'll see what happens. Of course, ultimately we need real monetary reform and a whole revamping of the financial system, which is so corrosive now and keeping us all in the basement in terms of purchasing power versus all the debts and huge price structures that are out there. Yeah. So, you know, it's a multifaceted thing, and that would be a good first step.
Okay.
All right, excellent. Well, let's follow on from that, from that particular thing, and say it is, of course, only the UK column and the British Constitution Group that are pushing for a key solution to this problem in UK, and that's restoration of the Bradbury pound. So this is essentially currency issued as credit on the wealth of the nation. If you've never read anything about this before, get onto the UK column website. You might start with this one, which is Bankers, Bradbury, Carnage and Slaughter on the Western Front. But there is a solution to the international banking cartel issuing money, which they've created from nothing. And the Bradbury pound is real. It was used. It's still regarded as currency by the Treasury, we understand. And restoration of this would start to take the lid off the banking cartel. Now, we've been encouraging people to do things, not just watch and listen. This was sent in to us. We think it's really excellent. Somebody's created a front page for the Daily Express, and they're asking questions about the Bradbury pound and the early day motion. This, of course, was the motion supported by Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell, plus MPs Austin Mitchell, Kelvin Hopkins and Paul Flynn. So they signed an early day motion to say, yes, we think the Bradbury's a good idea. But surprise, surprise, Mike, they don't want to talk about it anymore. And why do we think that is? Because they've now been spoken to, because, of course, restoration of the Bradbury would be the start of bringing down the international banking cartel. But my main point here is that somebody has acted on the Bradbury pound information. They're now challenging people about it. And that's exactly what we need to do under the phrase that we used at the Nottingham event, action conquers fear. So here are the emails of those gentlemen. One of them doesn't appear to have Twitter addresses. One of them doesn't appear to have a Twitter account. So that's Kelvin Hopkins. I've put up his personal website. But we're saying to people, challenge these MPs. They signed the early day motion. Now they're backing out. It's duplicity. And if we look at the little logo there for Jeremy Corbyn, the cynicism of this is unbelievable. He says, for the many, not the few. Well, actually, what he means is for the bankers over the money. So please challenge this man and his colleagues. And also bring you back to the UK column again. There's a whole wealth of information. If you simply search for Bradbury, and you'll find a whole list of articles talking about why the Bradbury is so important and why we need to support the restoration. And one of the reasons we need to get into this, well, here it is. David Cameron has got so much money he can spend £25,000 on a garden shed to write in. I'm not sure he can actually write, Mike, but many people got on this and said this is outrageous. That we've got people in poverty as a result of his so-called austerity measures, no austerity for Cameron, and he's building Well, he didn't build it, of course. Somebody's built him this wonderful shed. So we're saying get on to Mr. Cameron and challenge him. And I'm going to bring in Tony Blair as well, because, of course, we've reported that he's coming back into politics. He says he's a bit worried that people might drop what's it on his head. Well, I think something a lot more important needs to happen. We need to see people challenging this man over social media. If enough people do it, of course, his reputation can, political reputation will be utterly untenable. So we need people to act, particularly in this very important time of the election. Let us bring these candidates to account with the key questions.
Are we doing the IPCC story? We keep that till tomorrow?
I think we'll keep it till tomorrow, because okay, we're just about there on time. So if you're waiting for that update on the Independent Police Complaints Commission and Common Purpose, we will cover that tomorrow. Mark, we're going to say thank you very much for joining us, because we know your time zone means it is still in the middle of the night where you are in the States. So thank you very much for getting up and speaking to us. And we'll be delighted to have you on board again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you. That's the end of today's UK Column News. If you're not a supporter or a subscriber to UK Column, please get on the website and sign up. We need your financial support to do what we do. And we can't do it without you. That's it and all about it. Thanks very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye.